नमस्ते। सो इन दिस सीरीज ऑफ सनातन धर्मा, लास्ट टाइम वी स्पोक अबाउट द गॉड्स एंड द टाइटन्स एंड देयर रेसल एंड एम्ब्रेस, बिकॉज इट्स नॉट दैट दे ऑलवेज फाइट विद ईच अदर। द फर्स्ट थिंग वी हैव टू अंडरस्टैंड इज दे आर टू पोल्स ऑफ वन एग्जिस्टेंस। देर आर नॉट टू एग्जिस्टेंसेज, वन विच इज डार्क एंड वन विच इज ब्राइट। इट इज द माइंड कटिंग इट इन टू डुअलिटी। There are two poles of one existence. So existence starts from the utter darkness, inconscient, and climbs towards the light. And the first fellows or creatures or forces which help the growth, paradoxically, is the titans. So what do they do? Like any, we see that when a plant is there, its first stage is in the darkness. It has to be buried. The seed is buried inside. When all the waste goes into, you know, all the weight of the earth is crushing it till the outer crust becomes broken, and then it is drawn towards the light. Same thing we see in the baby in the womb. It's a symbol, the same symbol is repeated everywhere. So baby in the womb is growing through darkness. It doesn't understand who is its mother, why is it here, but it is taken care of somehow. And then the next step is when it comes and grows consciously toward the light, with a phase of transition in between, when it is still carrying the past and yet not moved towards the future. So these are the two phases, two stages, two poles of one existence. The journey is from the darkness towards the light. So this is one part of the journey. Second, the battle of the titans and the gods and their working together takes place on subtle planes. The gods are not beings of the physical world. Very often we'll see, you know, somehow in their serials, because they don't understand these subtle truths, so they will end up locating them somewhere on physical earth, like Shiva's Mount Kailash. Now there is a place called Mount Kailash and there is a place called Mansarovar, but it doesn't mean Shiva resides there. Shiva has his own place where it is called Kailash and Mansarovar, but on earth we see a reflection of it. And because human beings have this tremendous faith, and because it is in some way touched by that effulgence, so therefore by going there, people take it that they are coming in contact with Shiva physically. Although Shiva's residence is not on the material plane. Material plane he touches by his influence. And we see this in a very interesting story of the Devasur, the avatar of Lord Vishnu as the Kurma avatar, where he becomes the in the bed of the ocean, and there is the churning of the great ocean. That story we will talk about some other time. And when Amrit comes out, the nectar, so gods and the understanding was that both will drink it. But the moment it comes out, the asuras, they are waiting, they will snatch it and start running away. Now the gods don't know what to do. So gods also run. There is a melee, there is a fight which goes on. And as the story goes, from that kumbh which contains the nectar, few drops spill upon earth very clearly that this fight is going on in some other plane. And few drops which spill upon earth, they become sacred spots. So in India, so beautifully, the physical and the other planes, they are all interconnected in stories, in pilgrimage sites, in many legends, myths, they are interwoven. So the place where the spill takes place is called as where we have the Kumbh Mela. Now, very interestingly, we have some spots where only a little came down, that's called Ardhkumbh, and then you have Purnkumbh. So the interesting part is that the Purnkumbh takes place in what is called as Prayag, where large portion of Amrit had fallen. Few drops is good enough. And that's where Ganga, Jamuna and Saraswati are supposed to meet. Now Saraswati is a lost river. Now there are many stories about Saraswati being a lost river, it went underground, and all these stories are valid in the sense that there was actually a civilization which was nurtured and centered around the great river Saraswati, and then it went underground. But we can also understand it from a purely mystic point of view. Now see this story that the gods and the titans wrestle. The wrestle is going on there, but the wrestle is also in the human heart. So in the human heart, there are titanic forces, which are forces of division, darkness, ignorance, which pushes towards that side, and all the consequences thereof. And within us, there are the gods who are working working to carry the human soul and the human being upwards towards light, towards unity, towards harmony, towards beauty, towards love, towards sweetness, towards ananda. This is the working of the god. And titans, on the contrary, are doing the opposite. So the wrestle goes on. And as a result of this wrestle, see, literally the Meru, now we have the Meru Dand, the spinal cord. So sometimes the left side gets activated, sometimes the right side, the force and the knowledge. The side of the Merudand, which is creates, you know, a sense of excitement and aggressive kind of energies, which is called as a sympathetic nervous system. Even physically, you will see a correspondence. It's not that the story is about this. On earth, we find the correspondence of something else, which is happening elsewhere. But this tendency to say, oh, these stories were actually indicating about our nervous system. I saw a most absurd video which was being circulated by everybody, that there is a neurophysician who has told all Rama stories about the brain. This is absurd, because if this is true, then there is nothing worth about Rama. If all that the rishis were doing were telling us the structure of the human brain, saying that this is Rama, this is Lakshmana, then there is nothing worth striving for. They are realities of other planes which are expressed in human body as a symbol. On the other side, they are the gods who have a very calming influence. So the nervous system contains these forces nervous channels through which these forces can enter the human system and act. This is how it works. And in the center, the centering part is the Sushumna. The Sushumna is not a chain of nerves. The nervous system is sympathetic and parasympathetic. So what is Sushumna? It is the unseen nadi. It is the lost river Saraswati. So when the three are together, then we are in a state when we can receive Amrit. So if we have, now look at it, so interesting, even medical science will correlate with it. So if you have too much aggressive, ambitious person going on overdrive, then we are predisposed to develop certain kind of diseases like heart disease, etc. The actual studies called it type A personality. Strangely, the other type, very passive, very, dormant kind of person who just accepts to be a football, anybody comes, pushes, and he just, takes it like that. This is not true calm and true, quietude. This is a kind of passivity. So these are the people who can be, and they are called as type C. Nobody talks about type B. So type C are more prone to develop malignancies, etc., cancer. So it's a kind of study. So what is needed to be in good health? State of balance. So nectar of immortality, even before we arrive at immortality, the nectar nourishes us. It gives us good health. Not to be in good health, we have to be in a state of perfect balance and harmony. Means neither erring on this side nor erring on that side. Again, we see in the Gita, inner state, calm, equality. But at the same time, the battle of life which one has to go through. So every which way, we can see them at many levels. So the gods and the titans also wrestle within the human being. Even within the human body, they wrestle. So gods are forces that build up, things towards the light. And titans, they destroy. So if we give ourselves to titanic energies, excessive desire, ambition, etc., these forces will find a way to enter and start destroying our body cells, Or if we give ourselves to tamas, disintegrating forces, they are tamasic beings. And people who are tamasic have a tendency to, turn to alcohol and drugs, etc. On the other hand, and violence, very importantly. On the other hand, people who are more prone to sattvic energies. Now they are the ones where, what are sattvic energies? Energies of harmony and light and joy. So they help the nerves and the cells to recover. So it's a whole science in itself. The gods and the titans fight on some other plane. The repercussions are within us and upon us. Equally, on earth, there are representative of gods and the titans. So there are beings who are vibhutis of the divine. Shri Krishna speaks about them. And what is their role? They are doing the works of the divine as vibhuti. So what is a vibhuti? Vibhuti is somebody in whom there is a exceptional energy or capacity in one particular dimension in nature. Excessive intelligence. Now this intelligence turned towards Godward use becomes a vibhuti of the divine. The same intelligence turned towards demonic uses Harvard professor, but wanting to take away faith and, you know, living only for one's own selfish reasons, becomes demonic. The same energy. Same with emotions and every other energy which we receive as a gift of grace. In some people, it goes beyond the normal human limit. Such human beings act beyond the average human pitch. And because they act beyond the average human pitch, sometimes they are regarded as even gods, etc. There is a human tendency to deify such people. So they are vibhutis. They are vibhutis of the divine. Similarly, there are vibhutis of asuras. The mother speaks of Theo being a vibhuti of death. Now here she has used the word vibhuti in this sense that they are doing their work in the world. So there are like that. The vibhutis of both kind. Though in the Gita it specifically mentioned about beings with an exceptional and abundance. Meaning thereby all greatness belongs to God. It is because of that. Sometimes, you know, because nature works in such a way in these beings that there may be even a kind of imbalance at another level. Because, you know, there is abundant energy which flows through the being. Unlike, you know, normal, average, ordinary humanity where there is a limited amount of energy turned for limited purposes. So there are representatives of gods and the titans. And they fight. Like the famous Second World War where Sri Aurobindo says that Axis powers and the Allies powers. Allies powers are fighting for the divine. Even though they themselves may not be good guys. But doesn't matter. They are on the right side of history. They at least stand for some values and ideals. So again, vibhutis doesn't mean they are saintly people. They may not be. But they are on the right side of history. Whereas there are those who may be outwardly very religious. But they may be doing the work of death and destruction and titans. So we cannot go by appearances. It's about the inner state, the inner attitude, all these things which only the divine knows. So it's not just about seeing something outwardly. So this is how the evolution moves forward. But there are moments when evolution enters a very critical phase. When the battle has become so intense, when Devasur Sangram ultimately, probably the Asuras are going to win. They have the Kumbhak. Now if they win, you can imagine, like, you know, artificial intelligence, you create robotic beings. Can you imagine the potential of that? Imagine if it is in the hands of the ISIS or, you know, the kind of communist China, the government, what devastating effect it can have. You have a whole army of robots. What it will... So it's literally like it has reached a crisis point. Then what happens? Because there is the original divine plan, then Lord Vishnu appears. He appears as Mohini. He says, I am going to distribute. And both agree. Because it's now the Vaishnavi Maya of the Lord. And all of them are overtaken by it. And then we know final result is that the gods win the victory. But not the gods, it is the divine who wins the victory through them for earth. So evolution at some point enters into a very critical phase. When there is every chance that humanity and earth is going to deviate from the original plan. Actually, original plan is what is called as dharma. Dharma is the law of truth. Law of truth means original plan. Now, law of truth is built by the principle of sacrifice. Meaning thereby, all creatures will have their share. Practically, it means if I live only for myself, my selfish thing, I am actually deviating from dharma right then and there. But if I live with the idea that this world is one unit and everybody must have their own share and I am not here only for myself, my sake or my family's sake, then I am actually living with the sense of something larger, then I am more aligned with dharma. But because the evolution is based on freedom, there is a tendency for human beings to deviate. And slowly, and the asura is there prompting them, Arey, why do you want to live for others, take care of your own life, your own self, make more money, you know, and make more money, there is never enough money. So that's the other way. You must strive for this position, that position. If you are, you know, if you don't succeed, nobody will bother about you. These are all asuric suggestions. When you read the Gita, what is asuric sampada? This is asuric sampada. I have made so much money, I'll make more wealth tomorrow. I have defeated my enemies, I will defeat them tomorrow. So this is how the asura starts grappling, you know, taking hold of man. And slowly human beings under the garb of practicality, etc., they deviate. So when they deviate more and more, the world comes under the shadow, which is called as the Dharmasya glani. Dharmasya glani literally means it's not about following a particular religion or not. In fact, one may follow a religion and be in a state of dharmasya glani, because one has completely distorted the original truth. So what has happened? Dharmasya glani means the cosmic order, the law of truth has entered into a state of decline. Now when that happens, God has a, not a backup plan, original plan. If you read the Bhagavad, because it is all foreseen. So we see that Sri Krishna creates out of himself a being who lies on the cosmic waters, who is the first avatar. And Mother speaks of this first avatar. Normally we speak about first avatar as Matsavatar. This is a slightly misconception. Matsavatar is the first avatar in this cycle of Chaturyug. But there is an original avatar. Mother speaks about meeting this original avatar. And she speaks of, even in Savitri, about the first avatar. The first canto is about the first avatar. So he is in the cosmic waters and he has entered into creation. Now time to time, whenever there is a crucial moment, he opens his eyes and he enters into the play. Meaning thereby, there are points when evolution reaches a very critical juncture, then it is no more vibhutis. They can't handle it. You know, they say, look, it's beyond us. So the divine himself casts himself into the play, stands in the forefront of the human quest, and becomes the leader of the march of humanity or the evolutionary process upon earth, and that is the avatar. So this is the first time we see. Often people say that, you know, everything is there in the Vedas and the Upanishad. They miss out on the doctrine of avatarhood, which is first time brought to the forefront in the Gita. In the Vedanta, traditional Vedanta, there is something which can be called as a hint, but that is that divine is present in every human being. So in a certain sense, all of us are chinna avatars of the Lord. But this is not what is meant by avatar. All of us contain something of the Lord, like a seed, and that seed has to grow. So to that extent, we are all have already some blueprint, original print of the Sanatan Dharma inside us, which will guide us, which will help us, which will put a pressure from inside. That's why even the worst human being feels a need to justify. Even the most human being committing mass murders even has a soft corner for someone or something, like Hitler loved his dog and loved one, you know, I forget the name of, you know, his friend. He loved them because there is this love which is inside the human heart. And love is the power which brings people together, brings energies together, harmonizes them, carries them up. So Vishnu Bhagwan comes time to time as avatar, but Lakshmi ji is always present in creation. That's why, you know, we see that Lakshmi has gone into the ocean from the heavens, a very interesting story. And during Sagar Manthan, she comes out again and goes to Vishnu, meaning thereby she has worked in the subconscious till a time when now, okay, now it will enter next phase, and she goes back to Vishnu. It's very interesting, amazing story. Because if you see, after Kurma avatar, you have Vara, and then Narsingh avatar, when Vishnu Bhagavan will start coming. So this story about the avatars is essentially that God descends himself into creation. Now this has to be, the word is very loosely used nowadays, you know, thanks to the movie and many such notions. So sentimentally we say any Mahapurush is an avatar. Now Mahapurush is Mahapurush, and there is a general term. Avatar means descent. So a being from higher consciousness can be regarded as an avatar in a very general sense. Say beings coming from illumined mind, a seer, many of these rishis wear avatars in the general sense. But the Gita uses it in a very specific sense. And that specific sense is that the Supreme himself enters into creation. He is not some being of a higher plane. Like Hanuman is Rudra avatar in that sense, Shiva's avatar. But if you read through the Ramayana, who is the avatar? The Lord himself is Lord Rama. He is divine who has assumed a human body. Though if you see the parable of the avatars, the divine assumes different forms, very clearly evolutionary forms. He becomes first the form of the water, the fish, then Matsavatar, then in this cycle, then he becomes Kurma, half land, half sea, then he becomes Vara, land, and then he becomes Narsingh, half human, half animal, and then he becomes Vamana, the dwarf man, the psychic being. That means from the animal, the transition from human takes place because of the Vamana, the psychic being, which towers to heights of heaven and depths of the subconscious. This is the potential of the psychic being, the Vamana. And then we see Parshuram, when the psychic being in man develops the sense of justice, tremendous rajas, and he says that whatever contradicts, whatever is unrighteous, whatever contradicts the law of truth, I am going to slay. But slaying is no solution. So Rama comes and says, no, wait. I'll teach you how to be, how human beings should be. So he brings the illumined sattvic mind. And then when humanity reaches that point, when the animal is tamed, the Rakshasa is slain inside, then Krishna comes and says, no, evolution is not over. You have to go beyond. What is beyond? I'll tell you what is beyond. Beyond is freedom and delight. Three gunas, tamas, rajas, sattva is not the crux of human life. Rama represents sattva-gun, rajo-sattva. And Sri Krishna tells that rajo-gun moving towards sattva is deva-type. He defines what is a deva-type of humanity, god-like humanity. It is where rajas means energy of life is turned towards sattva. Whereas who is an asuric type, the life energy rajas turned towards tamas. That person is always busy dividing, degrading, disintegrating society. Whereas another which is moving towards sattva, which is towards harmony, beauty, light, etc. But this is within the human range. So Sri Krishna comes and says, wait, there is something beyond. So what does Sri Krishna comes to show us? That there is freedom and delight. Freedom and delight. Gopis and gopis come and listen to his gospel. But the earth reacts very violently. It convulses. How can one be free and happy forever? So we see the great war and Krishna's return. His own kul doesn't accept it. So Krishna has come as a precursor of the future. That is why he is regarded as the ultimate template. He has come and shown what will be the future of humanity. What it will be? Freedom and delight and love dancing upon earth. But earth is not ready. So God comes to pay the debt on behalf of man. First as Christ. That look, I will. Or rather first as Buddha. Buddha comes and shows the asuric energy how to moderate desires. How to, if you are not interested in earthly evolution, go into the beyond. Buddha came and gave this great teaching. How to get rid of ego and desire, which is a tremendous contribution of the Buddha. Then comes Christ to pay the debt of man. So he pays. He says, no, I have signed by my blood. Man is not ready. So I'll pay on his behalf and bring some compassion into man. And then we see in that same series Kalki. And what does Kalki do? He finally brings the kingdom of heaven upon earth. Which is, what is Krishna's dream? What is heaven upon earth? Freedom, delight, ananda. There should not be any suffering. Beatitude, love. Spontaneous wisdom, not the laboring mind trying to struggle, analyze, understand, read books, gather information. Still it fails to understand. So this self-revealing wisdom, which is locked inside us, he opens. But what Kalki Avatar does, first he establishes truth. So he drives away the mlechhas. He carries the sword of knowledge, which is the flashing sword in his hand. And he's on that white horse, which is the pure spiritual force, the divine mother's force, energy. So this is how he goes, and he is also imaged as lame. So someone had asked, what is the meaning of the lame avatar? Lame avatar means one foot is moving forward, but the other is resisting. But he carries, despite the resistance, he carries the earth forward. So he embodies both the forward movement and the resistance. So people are waiting for Kalki. But if you read through Sri Aurobindo's writings and read through the entire avatar, this thing, you discover that Kalki is right there. And it's not a question of sentiment, very logically. And that's what we are going to see now. So what does the Gita reveal about the avatar? When does he come? When there is Dharma Siglani. Look at today's century. We may not like Kali Yuga and all that, but look at 100 years behind. Never was the world darker than the previous century. Who were the asuras ruling over earth? Imperialism, Marxism, slavery, women, the shakti relegated to the floor of the house. Everything possible, extreme division, disintegration. Now we are so conscious about racism. 100 years back, racism was a way of life. The civilized society of Great Britain, which was ruling India, there were in cinema halls inscription. What? Dogs and Indians are not allowed. I have cross-checked it. It is true. There was such a racism, you know, Macaulay's system of education, that we don't want Indians to improve. Even IQ tests, incidentally, there was IQ test devised just to prove that Asiatics are inferior. So in the test, interwoven within the test, were certain things which only an English-speaking person can answer. So they were IQ tests, even till some time back, they were used for selection. Now, if you didn't know how to speak English, you couldn't really answer it. And, you know, sometimes I feel very strange, since we are at it, the recent thing about Sanskrit and people revolting against it, I find so absurd that people are ready to accept English, but not Sanskrit. Just 100 years back, based on this capacity to speak English, we were categorized as slaves or masters. And today, that language of the slaves, we accept. Now, it has a different meaning for us. Today, it's an international language. That's another dimension. But we are ready to accept that, but we are not ready to accept Sanskrit, which is the root of this country. But that apart, that's for some other time. So, dharmasya glani. Everything possible you can imagine, science had declared, there is only matter and nothing else. Dharmasya glani. There is no other. All that we need is nature, mechanical force, and we need a few atoms of hydrogen. That's all that is required, and creation is self-explained. Of course it is self-explained. You can explain the car completely without bringing in the car maker or bringing in the driver or the owner. You don't have to bring in. You can explain the car. Based on nature's processes, you can explain this whole world. There is no doubt about it. Even those few atoms, that origin. But the intent, the will, none of these we can understand. But this was 100 years back. And look at the world today. 100 years back, it was those two gory wars, dharmasya glani. Now, during this phase of dharmasya glani, what happens? That's the time the avatar comes. Yada yada hi dharmasya glani bhavati bharata abhyutthanam dharmasya tadatmansya jamaham. I come to restore the cosmic order. Who fits the bill? Take the names of all the great masters during that time. You will see only one and one, Sri Aurobindo. Look at his writings, Secret of the Vedas. He first time gives us the secret. What is there in the Vedas which is worth study even now? There have been Vedic commentaries, several, but always you will find a lacuna remaining. But Sri Aurobindo gives us the complete picture. Upanishads, Gita. He speaks explicitly in the Alipur jail, where Shri Krishna comes, Vasudev, and gives him the way to interpret the Gita, the scriptures, the Vedas. He gives a new nirukta, literally the rules of the grammar as should be used. You know, everything. So, very clearly, abhyutthanam dharmasya. But dharma is, in the Indian thought, is not just something static. It's not a rule book made in Arabia about 2000 years back, which everybody must follow till eternity. Dharma is not that. And if we try to do it, we'll miss out on the point. Dharma is also evolving. There is dharma, the root which holds us all together, the stable basis of all mutable existence. But also dharma is something which unfolds in time and space. That's why we understand that a child's dharma is different from a grown-up dharma and an adult dharma. The dharma of the four varnas we talked about, maybe some other time we'll speak about. The Brahmins had to adhere to the strictest norms of dharma because they were supposed to be the torchbearers. Then Kshatriyas. Why? Because for each type of humanity, there is a different dharma. So dharma was not something fixed for all. But dharma was something which, as we evolved, the dharma was a means for unfolding of the law of truth through the different stratified sections of the society. So not only he restores dharma, he gives it a new boost, just like human beings are reborn. So he gives it a new body and a new form which is more suited for the coming age. So he gives a yug dharma. Like Rama gave the dharma about the family and the rajya, raj dharma. Shri Krishna gives the rashtra dharma. And Sri Aurobindo comes and gives the dharma for the whole world. Read this ideal of human unity again. Who has written like that and shown the blueprint? Even what will be the religion of the future? He speaks about the spiritual humanity, spiritualized religion of humanity, which will be the religion of the future. And what will be its ruparekha, its form, that where every person will discover the inner Godhead and will be driven by that, and plenty of writings in detail. So yada yada hi dharmasya glani bhavati bharata abhyutthanam adharmasya tadatman sujameham. I lose myself, cast myself forth into birth. And then paritranaya sadhunam. Who gave that release? People showed spiritual paths, way of nirvana. That has been happening since ages. But who showed what is truly good, noble, beautiful in humanity? Paritranaya sadhunam. The good energies, paritranaya sadhunam, outwardly is that to give shelter and save those who are good people. But it is not only that, that is the external action. But also the goodness within us must ascend to a new level. If we look at Mother and Sri Aurobindo's work, in fact, Sri Aurobindo says in the mother, if you turn to her, she will release the godlike elements in you. This is literally paritranaya sadhunam. The godlike elements. What are the godlike elements? Love. But love is enmeshed in egoism, desires, in human beings. But love is still godlike element. See, Savitri, it is still the power which can save the world. It is man's lean on the absolute, but here it is distorted, disfigured. So he releases it, shows what is the true way to love. What is true bhakti? It is not something superficial, sing, jump, dance, but it's something deep within, it's self-giving. Nowhere we find this kind of description of bhakti, mother's prayers and meditations, document of bhakti. Similarly, light, what is knowledge? Knowledge is the truth of oneness. How we can arrive at this? Through human evolution, not through gathering of books and book information, not through panditya, but by ascent of man from the rational to the intuitive level. What else is in human beings which is godlike? Will. But where is it given? It is given to all kinds of temporary, transient gains. This much money, this position, power, that's what human beings are running about. So the will has become weak. So what do Mother and Sri Aurobindo teach us? How to tune this will to the divine will. Now it is there in the scriptures, but it has got enmeshed. And the only will left was will to escape into nirvana. Rest is about worldly life. But Sri Aurobindo and the mother show us how this will can be tuned to the divine will. How this will can become a powerful dynamo for God's work. Savitri lines, man is a dynamo for God's work. Nature does most in him, God the high rest. Only his soul's consent is his own. Paritranaya sadhunam. And then vinashaya cha duskritam. Here also we see a double action. One of the outer action of paritranaya sadhunam is independence of India. One of the actions of Sri Aurobindo outwardly paritranaya sadhunam is in Second World War. So much he supported the allies, how they were saved, many of them. They're all memoirs are there. Those who want, they are documents written by people who didn't even know Mother and Sri Aurobindo and how they were helped. Paritranaya sadhunam, both within and outside. And vinashaya cha duskritam. One single figure who didn't only speak but actually stood in the forefront. First, vinashaya cha duskritam, literally driving away the malicious powers. Sri Aurobindo, the one most dangerous man in India. And at the same time, he didn't stop there. There it's simple work, he could do it. But also in the Second World War. So vinashaya cha duskritam, but also within human nature, all the dark tendencies to be transformed, this entire work is that. धर्म संस्थापना स्थाए संभवामि युगे युगे. इफ वी वेरी इम्पर्सनली डिस्पैशनेटली विदाउट ब्रिंगिंग एनी सेंटिमेंट जस्ट फॉलोइंग द ट्रेल ऑफ व्हाट द गीता हैज गिवन वी विल सी वेरी क्लियरली दैट दिस इंटरवेंशन ऑफ शिरोबिंदो विच टर्न द टाइड ऑफ टाइम इज वेरी क्लियरली द फंक्शन ऑफ द अवतार एंड देयर आर मेनी हिंट्स दे डायरेक्टली गेव. I mean, even Mother was asked about Kalki being lame. She said, yes, this collective suggestion led to Shurbindo's fracture in 1938, which was the result of the resistance of the world. So it works both ways. So that lame foot represents the resistance of humanity, the hostile forces. So that is how he took it upon himself. We can understand that accident in this way. He took upon himself all the resistance of humanity so that he can bring to it light and freedom. And immortality. Goal is freedom and delight, but without truth, not possible. So, supramental consciousness. Unless there is the vast truth and the harmony that it creates, man cannot go towards the freedom and delight which Sri Krishna proposes. Original plan is that. So, he also says, we are doing what Sri Krishna initiated. We are going to fulfill that work. So, he lays the base of truth. If we do it on the basis of ignorance, freedom will become licentiousness. Delight will become all kinds of pleasure seeking in the name of Sri Krishna. So, this is the story of the avatars. They come in the meaning thereby God does not run the government in absentia. He actually enters and leads the human being, shows by his own example. Look at fearlessness, Sri Aurobindo's own life. The courage. We can't even speak against a little bit what is wrong because of fear. Not speaking because of a high attitude is different. Oh my God, if we do it practically, harm will come to me. This is the human state. Shrinking. We please people simply because it will be helpful to us. Look at Sri Aurobindo. He is standing not against a human being, against an empire about whom it was said that the sun does not set. And the day they took Sri Aurobindo to Alipur jail, the sun had started to set on the British Empire. So we can see very clearly the avatar comes as the leader, and like Sri Krishna blowing his flute, there are some who follow him. It is not a question of belief or non-belief. The soul doesn't care about belief and non-belief. It doesn't care about analyzing. It just follows the call of the flute. So there are some who feel the call, hear the call, we can say call of Sri Aurobindo towards the new creation, and they move towards it. So in the line of Sanatan Dharma, we can say Sri Aurobindo represents the last avatar. Why the last avatar? Because after this, no more human body, supramental being, supramental body. I am not going into its detail because it's a whole aspect, but he's the last avatar in a human body. After that, human beings will come, but no more in a human body. That's why you see why the parable stops at 10 avatars. How can kingdom of heaven be established if matter is still untransformed? It is only hinted. So we see Sri Aurobindo comes and develops it to its fullness. So we read just a passage from Sri Aurobindo, from the Gita. And essays on the Gita, page 165. The Gita lays stress upon the struggle of which the world is the theater in its two aspects, the inner struggle and the outer battle. In the inner struggle, the enemies are within. In the individual, who are these enemies? And the slaying of desire, ignorance, and egoism is the victory. Inner Mahabharata is about slaying egoism, me and mine. Desire and ignorance, that is the victory. But there is an outer struggle between the powers of the dharma and the adharma in the human collectivity. So in India, we don't have papa and punya has come much later. It is dharma and adharma. And we have spoken about it, I think, in some of the talks. So the former is supported by the divine, the godlike nature in man, and by those who represent it or strive to realize it in human life. The latter by the titanic or demonic, the asuric and rakshasic nature, whose head is the violent egoism and by those who represent and strive to satisfy it. There's a whole nexus of Asuric forces who want to build an empire of falsehood, and they succeed for a moment like Ravana in Lanka, but only it will be demolished, because in the original plan it is the divine who stands in the heart of creation, and at every crucial moment he also becomes the leader of the march. This is the war of the gods and titans, the symbol of which the old Indian literature is full. The struggle of the Mahabharata, of which Krishna is the central figure, being often represented in that image. The Pandavas who fight for the establishment of the kingdom of the Dharma are the sons of the gods. You see, all of them represent some aspect of God. One represents, you know, Dharma, another represents force, third person represents that skillfulness and, you know, many aspects of the gods. Health, vitality, youth, love, all these are aspects of the gods. Their adversaries are incarnations of the titanic powers, the Asuras. Why? Violent, aggressive egoism, ambition, all these are traits of the Asura. This outer struggle to the avatar comes to aid, directly or indirectly. Shurbindo, Second World War, during, and also the against the imperialism powers. He also fought against all this materialistic thought by his own another way. This time not with the sword but with the pen, where we see the entire materialistic thought is wiped away almost from the world. Materialism itself has led to the discovery that there is a divine possibility. This is the beauty. As if somebody came and rewrote the whole thing. The evil doers, and in them depress the power they represent, and to restore the oppressed ideals of the Dharma, he comes to bring nearer the kingdom of heaven on earth, in the collectivity as well as to build the kingdom of heaven within in the individual human soul. So there are the two aspects of the action of the avatar, individual and collective. Now comes, what should we do then? Wonderful, avatar has come, done his work and gone. What is the final take-home point for us? The inner fruit of the avatar's coming. Who really gains the fruits? The inner fruit of the avatar's coming is gained by those who learn from it the true nature of the divine birth and the divine works. Mother says, those who simply by faith in the divine sacrifice in matter, they will be redeemed. And at another place in this very book, he describes that the avatar, when he comes, he becomes a permanent part. But always then this descent becomes in the soul of the race a permanent power for the inner being and the spiritual rebirth. So Shubhendra and the mother are permanently established in earth, in the soul of man, just like Christ and Krishna. They become realities. And it's just that now it's up to us. So what the soul has to do? One is that it must learn from it the true nature of the divine birth and the divine works, so that we too can follow that lead. And who, growing full of him in their consciousness and taking refuge in him with their whole being, manmaya, mam, upashrita, purified by the realizing force of their knowledge and delivered from the lower nature, attain to the divine being and divine nature, madbhavam. So what is required is first to understand that this is the work that they came to do. And then take refuge in him with all our being. And then to allow them, madbhava, madgata, that to be driven by their force, by their infinite shakti and radiance and love. The avatar comes to reveal the divine nature in man above this lower nature, and to show what are the divine works. So what is the sign of divine works? He comes to show. What is the sign? Beautifully described. Free, not bound, attached. Even sometimes we can be attached to works which we think are divine works. We can get attached to chairs, in departments, in everywhere. Oh, I am the Mahamandaleshwara. I was going to say something else. Yeah, people get attached till the last moments. Mother and Shri Aurobindo have shown in their own life how one, they divine themselves, how she has shown the way forward. So many aspects, that all that is there in glimpses, so I am not speaking of it. But what is divine works? Free. What is this freedom? Freedom from ignorance, from the fruits, from success and failure. That is a poem of Sri Aurobindo, Divine Worker. That if one reads, one finds it beautifully. What is really divine works? And he says, victory is thy passage mirrored through fortune's glass. Failure is thy failure is cradled on thy deathless arms. So what we call as failure, it is he who is upholding it still. It's a temporary hold. Failure is cradled on thy deathless arms. Victory is thy passage mirrored through fortune's glass. And then he says, I do thy works and pass indifferent to the time snake's crawling length. How long it will take for the supramental manifestation? 100 years, 200 years, 1000 years, 10,000 years. How does it matter? For a divine worker, somebody who has really practiced karma yoga in the true sense, it will not matter. Because he is here to do what the divine commands him to do. So free. And then what is that security? No power can slay my soul. It lives in thee. Thy presence is my immortality. He relies only on the divine, not on any human agencies for success. He is not looking for recognition. So the next is free, unegoistic. Not that, you know, I have done so much work. How stupid it would be. Even the one whose I is identified with the great I doesn't say that. I. Egoistic. So his work, divine worker, is unegoistic. Sri Aurobindo and the mother's life, we will see a living example. We see in Sri Krishna's and Lord Rama's life. So all those we have already spoken of. Disinterested. It is not done with that attachment to things. Impersonal. It flows. Because one is vast and no more egoistic, so the Shakti flows through the person. Impersonal. Universal. It's not confined to this or that small little object for oneself, for one's petty gains. Full of the divine light, the divine power, and the divine love. Three things. In that work, divine worker is always full of these three aspects. Light, power, and love. Divine light, divine power, and divine love. He comes as the divine personality. Not only as to show us the way, he is the divine personality. He comes as the divine personality which shall fill the consciousness of the human being and replace the limited egoistic personality so that it shall be liberated out of ego into infinity and universality. That's why just simply remembering Mother and Sri Aurobindo, it fills us. It drives the ego away. See, after having a bhajan like Sri Aurobindo, Nami Anando, how can you take your own name and take joy in it? Sri Aurobindo, Nami Anando. Is another beautiful bhajan. Speaks about, He Ananta Divya Purush, Sakal Kalushahari, Koti Koti Kanth Kare, Vandana Tumhari. Now, you know, when we turn toward the divine and look at his vastness, how can one fall back into pettiness and think of oneself? Put a nameplate outside the house, this is my house. Put photographs inside of a transient being whom next moment will be gone. One lives in the sense of eternity, infinity, universality, impersonality. So that it shall be liberated out of ego into infinity and universality, out of birth into immortality. Just by remembering the divine as human birth, it's enough to free us. He comes as the divine power and love which calls men to itself so that they may take refuge in that and no longer in the insufficiency of their human wills and strife of their human fear, wrath, and passion. Divine is saying, I will take your burden. Mother says, we are precisely not in an age when men are left to their own resources. They have come to help us. But we don't believe. We believe in doctors and whoever else. So they come to say that we are ready to lift your burden. And they come with love, all love in their heart, so that we can take refuge in them. and liberated from all this unquiet and suffering, anityam asukham lokam, may live in the calm and the bliss of the divine. What they are going to give us in return? People say, oh, I have to leave this pleasure, leave this food. Are you forget about leaving or not leaving? What you are going to be given is a constant state of joy. Is it something what we are striving for through all these complicated ways? It's just by remembering them, taking refuge, it comes. Nor does it matter essentially in what form and name or putting forward what aspect of the divine he comes. For in all ways, varying with their nature, men are following the path set to them by the divine, which will in the end lead them to him, and the aspect of him which suits their nature is that which they can best follow when he comes to lead them. So some see in Shri Krishna the Chakradhari, others the Radha Vallabh, then Mohan Murari, and then some see in him all these thousand names, no? Madhu Katabhari. You can see in so many ways. Madhusudana. So all these are various deeds and exploits. So same way some people can get attracted to Sri Aurobindo because of the love for India, freedom. Others may get attracted towards poetry. What a wonderful poetry. Still others can get attracted towards social and political thought. Then there are philosophers towards the life divine. What an author. Still others who are blessed may get attracted towards his personality, the divine personality, towards the love in his heart. As the mother says, who can understand Sri Aurobindo? He is as vast as the universe and his teaching is infinite. The only way to come a little near to him is to love him and give oneself unreservedly to him and his work. So if we have this to him and his work, so others are attracted to his Shakti, the divine mother. So whatever way, doesn't matter. Then accordingly he will come. If we are interested only in that Indian aspect, so he will come to us and help us make India better. Draw inspiration. Somebody, a philosopher, life divine, he'll say, okay, good. So he'll become a great philosopher by, you know, life divine and go beyond traditional Vedanta. Somebody will be drawn to the ideal of humanity. Some will give themselves completely. That's what Mother says. There are those who are ready to become intellectual disciples of Sri Aurobindo, but they are not ready yet for the new creation. And some will just take refuge in the Mother and say, whatever way you lead me, carry me. But I want things to change within, around, in this earth. Enough of ignorance, suffering, pain. Not just for oneself, but for the whole earth, one would pray. And she would say, all right. Now you are a material for the new creation. So to each one, the divine comes in his own way. In whatever way men accept, love and take joy in God, in that way God accepts, loves and takes joy in man. So some will come and say, oh no, no, I don't believe. I want to have wrestle. So God will say, okay, last wrestling I had done was with Kansa. You also come. I'll give you the embrace of the wrestler. And you'll see a whole section of humanity destroyed. Because it wants to wrestle with the divine. Through thought, ideas and whatever way. Doesn't matter. Whatever way men turn to him, he will come. And will give you that. The embrace of the wrestler, the embrace of the lover, the embrace of the seeker of knowledge, the embrace of the divine worker. Or we may come as the asura wrestling with the divine. So whatever way we come, in that way God accepts, loves and takes joy in man. Ye yatha mam prapadyante tans tathaiv bhajamyaham. Namaste.